Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. Melbourne Writers Festival ordinarily takes place on the unceded lands of the Kulin Nation, in particular the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people. I pay my respects to their elders and the elders of all communities across Victoria. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. For our opening night this year, we'd assembled an all-star lineup to deliver readings on Australia's foundational myths. Our first speaker, Stan Grant, is a Wurundjeri and Kamilaroi man. A journalist since 1987, he has worked for the ABC, SBS, Seven Network, Sky News Australia, and CNN. In 2015, his best-selling book, Talking to My Country, won the Walkley Book Award. He is currently International Affairs Analyst at the ABC.
Where do I begin? Away back in time, before we measured time in days and months and years, when time was a story. I can touch this time. It is still there, timeless. And every when. Yes, that captures it. Every when. It is there in the trees and the rocks by the riverbank and in blood. My family, all of them, no line between the dead and the living. No time that is past or present. I begin there. I begin at Lake Mungo, the site of Australia's oldest human remains and among the world's first ceremonial burials. I have slept under the timeless sky and stars and sat among the dried out lake beds and shell middens. I went there with family, blood, each of us tied to each other and this place. Where do I begin? In a land far from here, in Ireland, 2 centuries ago, and a young man who escapes the gallows and is put on a boat to this place. He brought my name, the sharp angle of his face. He brought a rebel's spirit that lives in me. He never saw Ireland again. He died here, an old man, still an Irishman, not yet an Australian. I begin in Ireland. I begin there in a time of horror and death, famine and curfews where Irish Catholics, my ancestors, were locked away, brutalized, heads displayed on spikes. I have walked Irish streets and heard the whispers of the ghosts of Belfast. I am tied to that place. Australia, do I begin there? Blood and name and history, these things are bigger than a nation. They outlast a nation. We sail our ships and we find each other. We are cast adrift on time and we set ourselves down and we call that home. A Chinese friend once said, home is the last step on our ancestors' journey. And then we take another step. I have worn the dust of many lands. Home has been London and Hong Kong and Beijing and Abu Dhabi and Islamabad. There are bits of me there forever still, where I have laughed, cried and loved, that is home. Wherever my wife and my children have been with me, that is home. You see, home is not permanent, not for me. It is not something I can own. It is not something that I can call my own. Beginning, there is no beginning. And there is an endless beginning. Home of exile. Give me exile. Give me restlessness. Give me uncertainty. Please don't, please don't, please do not give me identity. Please don't, please don't, please do not give me certainty. Please do not tell me what I am or who I am. Please do not talk of race or culture or nation. Please don't, please do not put me in boxes. Catholic or Protestant, Hindu or Muslim, Shia or Sunni, Hutu, Tutsi, Rohingya, Buddhist, black, white. Where we find boxes, we find hate. The Indian philosopher Amartya Sen calls these solitarist identities. We define ourselves, he says, not by who we are, but who we are not. We cling to our tribes and we tear ourselves limb from limb. I have stood in too many bombed out marketplaces and seen too much blood to have any time for identity. Belonging. Give me belonging over identity, because I have belonged in many places, amongst many people. Identity, let's banish the word. A writer should have no identity. So said John Keats. That's okay with me. James Joyce wanted to go in search of the unconstructed conscience of his race. Yes. James Baldwin went to France to write free. Toni Morrison sought to write herself free from a genderized, sexualized, racialized world. No, not write herself free. She was free. Her humanity defied the category of others. Beginnings and endings. Who can say where we start or finish? I know that I am here, and I know I am part of something that stretches way back and way forward. I know that I am temporary, that all things must pass, and I know that I am permanent too, never ending. This morning, I walked on the rocks by the ocean near my home, and I saw a pod of whales passing by. Just their water spouts in the distance, and then a mighty tail rising out of the water. And in that water and on those rocks was a truth that can't be measured on a clock or a calendar. Somewhere in the every when, the white sails are visible in the distance. The strangers are coming. 200 years of time melts away, and I'm standing on those same rocks, looking out at that same sea, and I am on those boats. I am banished from my land, and I am set a course for a new home. And I am on that shore, staring out at those strange shapes in the distance, those sails and ships I have never seen before. And death is coming, and the end of certainty is near, and it is unstoppable. And I hear old names, Bennelong and Pembleway and Patagarang and Barangaroo, and John Grant, an Irishman who in chains will board a ship still to come and bring my name. Something is ending as something is beginning for everyone in that moment. I see a trickle of water through the rocks making its way to the ocean, and there is a timelessness there, nature taking its course. I am reminded of one of the great films I've seen, Terence Malick's Thin Red Line, a story of war and destruction, an island paradise turned into a place of horror. And as the American soldiers sail away, a flower pushes itself up from a rock. Nothing ends. Who am I? Where am I from? Who are my people? Why do I need to even ask? Beginnings and endings. Why do we need them? I have never felt like starting a story. I know I can never complete one. I can only add my voice, a voice that is not the same today as it was yesterday or will be tomorrow. I can only join my voice to all those other voices in a story without end.
Aggie Coleman is a Noongar woman who writes fiction, essays, poetry, and art writing while either living in Nam or on the road. Her latest work is Lies, Damn Lies, a personal exploration of the impact of colonisation.
Not many Australians know the history, so not many are aware of Cook's real place in the historical narrative, in the foundational stories of the continent. Our current Prime Minister, who seems to be absent more often than he is present, desired to spend millions on reenacting Cook's circumnavigation of the continent, an event that never happened. Therefore, Morrison's proposal is technically an enactment. Around the time that Morrison announced his Cook enactment, his education minister of the moment explained to us that January 26 should be celebrated as the date when Cook came ashore with the First Fleet. Despite the fact that by the time the First Fleet arrived on this continent, Cook had already been dead for 9 years, having been speared, then strangled in the surf off Hawaii, and then having the flesh cooked off his bones. Yes, Cook really got cooked. Australians love to idolise Cook for the things he never did. Researchers interviewing or polling Australians have discovered that a large number of average Australians, perhaps the majority, have no idea what January 26 commemorates. The average Australian also seems unaware that Cook's greatest achievement on this continent, the most important contribution he made to the development of a colony, was mapping the East Coast and suggesting a site for colony on Botany Bay, where incidentally, the colony was definitely not established, because frankly, it was a terrible place for a British colony, but paradise for the Gweagal people who belonged there. No, Cook did not discover Australia. That had been done countless times. He was not the first person to set foot on the continent. An Aboriginal person was. He was not the first non-Indigenous person. An Indonesian probably was. He was not the first European. Jan Soon, a Dutch captain, was. Cook was not even the first Englishman to find the continent. That honour belongs to the captain of the Trial, who sunk off Western Australia, or to Ian Dampier, the privateer who went looking for the Trial, or most importantly, for its cargo. Most historians would agree that the most important thing Cook did to aid the establishment of a colony on this continent was to claim the East Coast for the Crown. Note, he only claimed the coast, having only landed crew and set foot on the continent three times. Once in Gweagal country, where he called Botany Bay. Once when he had to fix his ship after banging into the Great Barrier Reef. He was probably the first European to crash into the reef. I have to give him that. And then finally, on what is now known as Possession Island. His journal stated he had laid claim to the coasts and harbours of the East Coast. Only the East Coast. Because it was unambiguous that the Crown of England had no claim to the North, South or West Coasts because the Dutch were there first. And only the coasts, specifically. He did not explore inland because he was looking for harbours for the Admiralty and for British traders. So it seems certain Cook's greatest achievement was navigating to the continent now called Australia against the trade winds from the east, then sailing up the coast and mapping it. He really was a great navigator and an impressive cartographer. Oh, and he had the aid of a navigator from Tahiti called Tupaia, who was expert at navigating by the stars and currents and probably already knew the way. But to reiterate, Cook did not discover Australia. There were maps that predate him, maps he would have had access to. So what did he do for the foundation of the colony? He claimed the east coast of Australia, where most of the people live, for the crown. I guess that's something. He, according to his published journals, stood on Possession Island and claimed possession of the east coast of the continent in a move that's comparable to standing on the Isle of Man and from there claiming the entire west coast of Europe, which is incidentally smaller than the east coast of the continent now called Australia. Once he had made that claim, England had the right to claim the continent and set up a colony in Botany Bay, where they definitely didn't set up a colony, unless he did nothing of the sort. What does it mean for the mythology of the nation some call Australia if the story of Captain Cook claiming the continent for the crown is fake news? There were two journals published of that voyage, one from Lieutenant Cook, called Captain merely because he was captain of the ship, whose claim to this continent carries so much weight in the mythology of this colony, and another from Joseph Banks, the ship's botanist, a learned man, a noble man, whose opinion was almost certainly more important than that of the captain, who was a great navigator, but, we should all remember, a commoner, a mere seafarer. Both these journals agree on most points, including when Cook shot the first person he met on the continent. You didn't know about that? Cook's and Banks' journals agree that when Cook landed along Bay in Gweagal country, in what they call Botany Bay, there was resistance against landing from two men. They were the first natives of the continent the crew of the Endeavour had met, and Cook shot one of them. It's there in his journals and in those of Joseph Banks. B. Bits have been edited out of Cook's journals, but not that bit. He was proud of shooting that man. There was one important point on which the journals of Cook and Banks disagreed, but first we need to talk about the nature of the journals and the publication. That of Banks was edited by the man himself, and was published soon after the voyage he shared with Cook. Cook by then was away on his next voyage, and didn't have time to edit a journal into publishable form, so someone else did the job, after Cook had apparently edited them himself and perhaps made some changes that might suit the aims of the Admiralty and perhaps gain him a promotion. Nobody needs to hear me reading out of Cook's and Banks' journals in the original language. It's an archaic form of English where spelling, sentence structure and grammar were not really set in stone or even in custard. It would be easier if I just paraphrase in a more modern vernacular while avoiding the temptation to go too street. Because Cook was, after all, a working-class bloke. On August the 22nd or 23rd, 1770, Cook's journal said, and remember I'm paraphrasing, having claimed Botany Bay and the place where I dragged my ship ashore after I nearly sunk for the monarch, I've just now claimed the coast from where I first saw it to here, where I'm leaving it tomorrow. We fired muskets to celebrate, and the ship replied with cannons. On the same date, on the same island, Joseph Banks records in his journal, quote, again paraphrasing, we couldn't find a way through the islands, so we went to an island, climbed a hill, and from the top of the hill we saw a way through the clear ocean. Oh, there were some natives, but we scared them off. Bear in mind that Banks had nothing to gain. Cook's claim was used to justify the colony. And don't forget, Banks' journal was published under his supervision, and almost immediately, Cookies, way later, without his direct hand or voice in the editing process. I often say that when two sources disagree, the best way to determine which is telling the truth is to ask who has the most to gain from lying. In this case, it's Cook and his editors. Cook's journal is the primary source for the history for the story of Cook claiming Australia. So I want you to understand this. The evidence is not clear that Cook claimed Australia on Possession Island. So where does that leave us? And where does that leave Cook? Well, for a start, the narrative on which Australia is built, Cook discovering Australia and claiming it on Possession Island, is shaky ground on which to build a national legend. In reality, it was the arrival of a fleet of convict ships, led by Commodore, soon to be Governor Phillip, on the continent, on the 26th of January 1788, that laid claim to this continent, if it was empty, which it was not. It was the first fleet that started the colony, yet that is not as good a foundational legend, perhaps, as a mythical discovery by Cook of an empty continent. Phillip's arrival with the first fleet was a stronger legal foundation for a colony than Cook's claim discovery or claim of possession. But nations are not built on law. They are built on legend, on story. If Cook's claim loses its value, then what does Australia have? Perhaps that is why some people, those who are more interested in colony than truth, have raised a minor figure to the status of legend.
Santilla Chingepe is an award-winning journalist and filmmaker. She is a regular contributor to the Saturday Paper and serves as a member of the federal government's advisory group on Australia-Africa relations. Her first non-fiction book is forthcoming, and her documentary based on the book Our African Roots will air later this year on SBS.
Where do I begin? As a migrant to this country, I grew up being told and listening to various stories about Australia. From the cute and lovable stories about the wildlife that can be found across this continent to the horrors of colonisation and colonists bringing with them death, dispossession and disease. Alongside these narratives were tales of larrikins, battlers, bushrangers and feminists that were celebrated and in some cases revered as Australian folk heroes that seemed to exclusively hail from the Anglo Empire. They spoke to our sense of identity and in an unspoken way enforced the idea of Australian-ness, who was and what was deemed Australian. Even as a child, I knew that a lot of these stories weren't talking about me or people that looked like me. I began to accept this as though it was a fact. I was technically Australian, but not really. There are many foundational myths upon which constructions of the Australian nation have been based, and it's from these that we determine what constitutes Australianness and who is included or excluded from these identities. One of the foundational stories I've been increasingly drawn to is around colonisation and the singular story of Europeans settling on this continent. This curiosity took me deep into the historical archives, and I've spent a lot of time asking a lot of questions. And while I've emerged on the other side with even more questions than answers, what is evident is we're yet to begin to tell the full story of how this colonised country came to be. It is not a single story, but a complex and complicated one. Working with the archives has given me insight into some of these complexities. The process of going through the archives is as much personal as it is part of my job. I've long been fascinated by and tried to make sense of my African-Australian identity. Much of that has been shaped by dominant narratives that have sought to paint a negative picture of what it means to be African-Australian. As a journalist, I've always been driven by the truth, and that led me to the archives, where for the past 4 years, I've been uncovering the stories of people of African descent that were transported to Australia during the first few decades of the penal colony. As a Black African migrant to this country, my sense of belonging has always been questioned. I was born in post-colonial Zambia and have made my home in a post-colonial settler country. My own life has been shaped by the legacy of the British Empire and my own family's history as colonial subjects. The stories I discovered in the archive were life-changing for me on a personal level. For the first time, I didn't feel like an outsider in the place I call home. I could see myself and people that looked like me in this country's history. A foundational myth I've heard repeatedly is surrounding the events of colonisation. Almost every Australian knows the story. On the 26th of January, 1788, a fleet of British ships arrives in Sydney Harbour to begin the colonisation of the traditional lands of Australia's First Peoples. But what's less well known, and what my research has led me to discover, is that on the 6 convict ships that made up the fleet were at least 10 convicts of African descent. Depending on the historian, the number is estimated to be between 12 to 14 convicts of African descent. My conservative estimate is based on the convicts that I could verify as having African ancestry. These men and boys stepped off the ships and were set to work building the modern nation of Australia. They would, in the years that followed, be joined by hundreds of other men, women, and children of African descent that would be transported to our shores as convicts. Last year, I interviewed some of the descendants of a man of African descent who arrived in the first fleet of ships. John Randall was among those men of African descent that were transported to set up an open-air prison camp by the British in the new penal colony of New South Wales. More than two centuries later, his descendants, who now identify as white, would speak fondly of their relation to this man. They were white with a black ancestor. I'd later find out that John Randall's descendants today number in the tens of thousands. That's a lot of white people with African ancestry. I met with John Randall's descendants as part of a documentary I produced, together with my colleagues Tony Jackson and David Collins, called Our African Roots. The documentary, which airs on October 17 on SBS, is an invitation to begin telling the full story of Australia's modern origins. These origins are more complex and diverse than we've been led to believe, and the documentary unearths Australia's forgotten African history and reveals the central role people of African ancestry have played in events that shaped our nation, from the First Fleet to the Eureka Rebellion and beyond. This isn't rewriting history. It's what I like to call an act of reparative justice. Correcting historical wrongs that for so long have deliberately omitted the stories of First Nations people and people of colour from our national history, despite the fact that the evidence of their existence can be found quite clearly in the historical archive. Our African Roots is also an act of historical truth-telling, because it interrogates the myths of Australia's white foundation narratives and reveals modern Australia's origin story to be a complex, multicultural and multiracial affair. My research has since uncovered hundreds of African convicts and free settlers who arrived on these shores, and their presence is irrefutable proof that Africans have been part of Australia's story since Governor Arthur Phillip first raised the Union Jack at Sydney Cove. These men and women and their descendants left an indelible mark on Australia, becoming bushrangers, feminists, entrepreneurs, Eureka rebels, Anzac heroes, and sporting stars. Although their stories have been largely overlooked, they played a pivotal role in the emergence of modern Australia. And it's not just people of African descent. Looking through the archives, I found evidence of people from just about every corner of the world documented in colonial Australia. So why have these stories been overlooked? And is this erasure from our foundational stories unconscious or deliberate? Why don't we know the names of these men and women? I have a few theories about this, chief among them being racism. The legacy of the Immigration Restriction Act of 1901, better known as the White Australia Policy, meant that for a long time, we told ourselves the stories that reflected who we wanted to be, a reflection of a belief in the superiority of an Anglo empire. Any story that didn't fit this monocultural myth was excluded. Some might argue that these ugly parts of our history are not who we are anymore, and that those that espouse white supremacist ideals are but a handful of bad eggs that don't know any better. But to that, my response would be that while it might not be who we are today, it's about where we are now and how the legacy of these histories continues to play out in the lives of so many Australians today. As I give this speech, Australia's Security Intelligence Agency, ASIO, has raised concerns about the number of young Australians joining neo-Nazi groups, with claims that they plan to make Australia a white ethno-state. The head of ASIO has warned that right-wing extremists have emerged as the most challenging security threat currently facing Australia, with fears that a terror attack in Australia is probable. Rioters have taken to the streets in Melbourne in recent weeks to protest against vaccinations and lockdowns, with reports that some amongst them were far-right nationalists. They allegedly left in their wake stickers that read, "Australia for the white man." But Australia has never been for the white man. As a matter of historical fact, it's beyond laughable that this monocultural myth persists in 2021. Despite the absurdity of notions of white superiority, history shows us that these fictitious narratives can be deadly, dangerous, hateful, and disadvantage communities well into the future. So how did these ideas arrive on our shores with the colonizers? And why does racism continue to underpin the very foundation of colonized Australia? While it's not preserved in our cultural memory, some of the answers to these questions can be found in the archives. My ongoing research into slavery and colonialism in Australia is an attempt to tell the truth about colonized Australia by highlighting the stories of people of African descent in Australia's foundational stories. It is an important and timely story, a much needed opportunity to expand the notion of what constitutes an Australian story. It asks us to confront some of the ugly truths of our history, slavery, colonialism, and racism, and work to correct their legacy. It also aims to question prevailing narratives around Australian identity and highlights the role that history plays in reminding us of the importance of what the past can teach us when dealing with contemporary challenges around migration and belonging, and who gets to be labelled as Australian. Writing back into our history the stories of the people that were excluded from the national mythologies, and asking that we fully confront our past, is vital if we have any chance of reimagining a better future for all Australians.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.